Good evening, listeners. This is The Vanishing Season, read by Katie Darby, and indeed written by Katie Darby. Part 4. The story so far, James Emerson, scholar at Cambridge University in summer of 1892, is approached by his estranged friend Chester Whittingstall, the vicar of Weniston Village, St. Peter's Church, where he has discovered a magnificent doom painting that he wants to share. However, on reaching the station, Emerson discovers that Chester has been gone for the last 2 days, with no sign of where or when he will return. Undaunted, our hero views the painting alone by candlelight, is strangely fascinated and falls into a sort of trance while attempting to sketch some of the demonic figures therein, because the doom is, of course, the painting of the Last Judgment of Souls. Missing his train, he is forced to put up at the rectory overnight, and unable to sleep, he spies something extraordinary and disturbing in the graveyard, a sort of beast-like creature squatting above one of the new graves. And here we go. Contrary to all expectation, I slept soundly and solidly for the remainder of the night, only winching myself out of slumber when the housekeeper knocked me up to inquire when I would like to take breakfast. "Vicar always had it 8 sharp, she explained in a mumbled burr through a modest inch of open door, "and I likes to keep his customs."
Of course, I yawned. "I'll be down at once."
I felt as if I had taken some strong soporific drug. But in truth, it was only the incredible depth of sleep from which I was now rising slowly, like some dazed explorer of the fathomless ocean. Glancing about the room, I was aghast to see the sordid disarray which Mrs. Tydell, thank heaven, had been spared. A burned-down cigar abandoned upon the windowsill, my shirt and jacket cast heedlessly across the floor, and my tangled trousers half hanging off the edge of the bed. It was as if I had gone to my rest in a state of chaotic inebriation, rather than exhausted but relatively sober. I confess, I was rather disgusted with myself. I could hardly believe I had left off the tidy habits of my earlier school days and neglected even to pick up my clothes and hang them neatly on the wooden valet provided for the purpose, which stood in the corner. I frowned, ashamed yet also baffled by my own behaviour. What sort of inexcusable lapse was this? Next, I would be abandoning all pretense at civilised conduct and living like that feral fellow I had glimpsed. As with the breaking of a dam, the events of last night cascaded through my memory. All at once, and with daunting vividness, I stumbled to the window and flung open the curtains, then the casements, shading my eyes from the morning glare to search the graveyard for any signs of disturbance. There were none. No tracks in the sun-scorched grass, nothing torn up, broken, or even disarranged. Even the new burial plot on which I had spied the creature hunched seemed exactly as Oxborough had left it the previous evening. The shadow-haunted cemetery of nighttime now looked as innocent and commonplace in the beaming sun as it was possible to imagine. Everything was as it should be. It was inexplicable. I wish this serene vista could have persuaded me that I really had dreamt the whole episode, but all it did, alas, was render the experience clearer, more frightening, and more terribly real. The way that thing had looked at me. Those eyes. With no little effort, I repelled all thoughts of the nocturnal visitor and forced myself through my usual morning toilette, shaving with particular thoroughness and care. It was, I argued to my mirror self, through a cloudy beard of lather, man's ability to quash his atavistic impulses, to conquer his instinctive superstition and dread, which elevated him above the beasts and enabled him to strive for higher things. Therefore, It behooved me to shelve my foolish fancies and treat my vision of last night as exactly that, an hallucination, induced by fatigue and shock, as well as ocular and mental strain due to staring too long at a poorly illuminated and rather horrible old painting. Half convinced, at last, I descended the narrow old stairs and followed my pleasurably twitching nose into the dining room, where breakfast was laid out for one hungry gentleman, which was exactly what I found myself to be. I am usually rather abstemious at the morning repast, lacking inclination for much beyond coffee and porridge until at least noon. However, today I felt as hungry as if I'd not dined for weeks. So I set about the excellent food before me in earnest, ascribing my ravenous appetite to late hours and stimulating country air. Washing down my third helping of marmalade toast and boiled egg with Assam tea, I realised with a chuckle of recognition that I was consuming Chester's habitual breakfast, but with the inspired and generous addition of bacon, sausages and kidneys. I do hope, I remarked apologetically to Mrs. Tydell, that you did not get all this in just for me. I know Mr. Whittingstall is generally a light eater. The dim old woman looked almost frightened for a moment, then collected herself.
"Aye, sir, that he is, at least till 3 days back. I give him as usual, but then he bid me stay and asked if we'd out more substantial in the house. I tell him Mr. Oxborough often has bacon and sausage at midday if he don't go home for lunch, and he tell me to bring in the lot."
Is that so? Curious enough that changeless, frugal Chester should suddenly toss aside the custom of years, more so that this should happen the morning after he first saw the doom. Such a hearty meal implied, perhaps, a long journey ahead. And was not 3 days ago, Wednesday, the same day he had disappeared without word or warning? Had he known he might have to travel without stopping for some urgent reason? I frowned, puzzling out the mystery in hesitant stages. What could have happened between his discovery of the extraordinary painting which stood even now in the vestry like a jilted bride, forlornly awaiting him, and his disappearance the very next morning? What had he found out? Or realised? A hideous thought struck me. Had he, too, seen one of those things stalking the cemetery at dead of night and been frightened away from his own church? Oh, but in that case, whither had he fled, and why had he told nobody his destination? Questions thronging my brain. On impulse, I touched the arm of the housekeeper as she leaned over to replenish my cup. I'm afraid I startled her very much, for she spilled tea all over the tablecloth, only missing my shirt sleeve by a hair's breadth. "Oh, sir, forgive me," she gasped. "'Tis just... why'd you tug at me so?" "My dear woman, I would not dream of such a thing," I said. Rather put out. My polite tap had been the epitome of gentleness. "I only wished to know if you had heard anything outside the house last night."
"Outside?" she echoed, blank as a napkin, preoccupied in rubbing her arm. Was the woman simple?
"Yes, yes, outside. Did you hear or see a disturbance of any kind in the churchyard?" Her dull eyes brightened a fraction.
"Oh, no, sir. But I sleep on t'other side of the house. Besides, I'm a touch deaf, nor my sight ain't what it once was."
I realised glumly that she might have had the creature's hairy face crushed up against her windowpane and never known it. Then another question occurred. "Where," I asked her, does the vicar sleep? On the churchyard side of the house, or the other?"
"Same side as the guest chamber, sir," she replied. "Room next yourn."
The very next room. I thanked her, mired in thought before the words had left my lips. She hesitated a moment, then, sensing her dismissal, quietly withdrew. This revelation was not conclusive, far from it, but it was suggestive. If he had slept on the same side of the house as I, Whittingstall could well have seen what I had seen, that creature I wish I had dreamed, but began strongly to suspect I had not. And, had he seen it, he might have taken flight from the unnatural thing. Or else, and from knowledge of my friend, this was most likely the case, he had resolved instead to pursue it, with the same cold, bold rigour he once applied to hunting down obscure Gnostic texts. It was clear that in order to follow Chester's trail, I must return to re-examine the extraordinary composition which seemed to have set this queer mystery afoot. I swallowed the remainder of my tea, wiped my lips, and, quitting the rectory, set off towards the church with determination in my stride. It was a bright, singing morning, as lovely a one as God ever painted, and, still more wonderful, the hint of a supple breeze ruffled the hair of the trees and quivered the petals of the roses as I passed down the churchyard path. The door of the vestry was firmly shut, but I could hear faint humming, Chester's inescapable wandering Jim again, and a series of thumps and bangs from which I deduced that Oxborough must be somewhere nearby. I would find him, gain access to the vestry, and make a last, thorough study of the doom to see whether a re-examination in daylight furnished me with any more clues, either to the provenance of the artwork itself, or, a more distant possibility, alas, to my friend's unnerving disappearance. This much I owed Whittingstall, I knew, but equally, if I found nothing to lead me nearer him, I resolved to wash my hands of the whole enigma and instead persuade the rather too unperturbed local constabulary to prosecute their duties with more vigour. Much as I wished to find my friend, I knew my own amateur investigations could yield little compared to the efforts of Suffolk's professional police force. At that moment, Oxborough hove into view, his mournful, bearish face lit by an abnormally jaunty expression. Seeing me, he touched his cap and greeted me cheerfully. "Cooler this morning, eh, sir?" were his first words, and I had to agree that the sun had not yet chased all the early freshness from the air, though I feared this respite would not last. With that in mind, I got him to admit me to the vestry, and made him swear to return in an hour lest I fell spellbound again. "Though I am rather better rested tonight than yesterday," I added, "so I ought not to nod over my work this time." "Are you, sir?" His heavy brow lifted, alert. "No noises or nothing last night?" This took me aback, until I recalled the trouble he had been having with what he believed to be foxes. "Well, not really," I lied. "I mean, I dare say there was the odd noise. I slept with my window open because of the heat, you know. But nothing which kept me awake, I assure you." He looked less glad than before. "Mayhap them devils have moved on, or mayhap they ain't. Never mind which way, I shall put poison down tonight to make sure." I am a soft-hearted fellow, easily moved by the plight of my fellow beings, whether they go upon 2 feet or four, and I ought to have been sorry at this brutal solution. But I am ashamed to say that I was very much reassured by it. Oxborough opened the vestry for me, nodded, and went upon his way, whistling. I closed the door and turned back to look upon the doom once more. Now that I had seen it for the first time, unbiased, as it were, I felt justified in unfolding Chester's letter and perusing it again for references to the precise details he had found noteworthy, or wished particularly to call my attention to. It seemed, on rereading, that Chester too had attempted to sketch some of the figures, just as I had, but that his efforts had turned out very poor and unlike hardly recognisable. Unfortunately, he omitted to mention which of the characters he had tried to draw, but to speak honestly, he had never been much of a draughtsman, whereas I prided myself on my humble talent for capturing a likeness. With this in mind, I took out my little sketchpad and decided to copy down a couple of the more important figures in the painting. St. Michael, for one, was worth preserving, and Peter, perhaps, the mournful monkey-eyed Christ, I judged too peculiar for my pencil. Flicking through last night's work for a clean sheet, however, I was stopped in the act of turning a page by my own uncanny rendition of the pig-faced demon, or wild man, or whatever it was that squatted between hell's jaws on the bottom right of the vista. I am, by habit and self-training, rather a timorous artist, by and large, a light sketcher and frequent corrector of my own drafts, and a slow, methodical worker to boot. However, this drawing was entirely against my usual style. Heavily marked, almost scrawled, with a brute, blunt confidence of line I had only seen in certain impressionist works, it was as though another hand entirely had held the pencil. Curiously, I studied the creature that emerged from the page, holding my pad up beside its swinish original. They had little enough in common, if I was honest with myself, when it came to form and detail. Yet there was indubitably some shared quality. It was as though the same creature had been drawn from the life by different artists. One, the doom painter, careful, formal, meticulous, if grotesque. The other, frenzied, hasty, yet sure of its subject and vigorous to excess. In places, the point of the lead had all but scored through the page. There was something else about my own version, too. Unlike the flat stare of the painted devil, the round, bestial eyes of mine seemed to plead dumbly from the paper for I knew not what. Mercy? Understanding? Forgiveness? Its direct gaze unsettled me. It reminded me of the look in the half-glimpsed face of the thing from last night, which I had determined to try and forget. I took up Whittingstall's pages again, stopping at a place where he mentioned that the buildings of heaven on the extreme left of the painting were exceptionally reminiscent of a certain holy house, very familiar to me. He went on to wonder whether this evidently intentional reference was a clue or a key, perhaps, to the geographical origin and thus, ultimately, the identity of the artist. Staring curiously at the painted walls before me, I sighed. It was now evident that my friend, an academic sleuth if ever there was one, a tireless teaser out of references and solver of arcane puzzles when he was a student, had got the scent of this problem firmly in his nostrils and intended to run it to earth. Whittingstall, as a general rule so rational, intelligent, and composed, was nonetheless inclined, as so many brilliant scholars are, to monomania, once an idea had lodged in his stubborn head. I recalled how once, in Lent term, 2 years ago, he had become absolutely fixated upon an obscure reference in one of the apocryphal Gospels, I forget which, and determined to consult the authoritative commentary upon the subject. Nothing else would suffice. That the sole copy of this valuable manuscript was held in the Cotton Collection of the British Museum did not deter Chester in the slightest. He caught the evening train down to King's Cross and tramped the streets of London impatiently until the museum opened again the next morning and he could read the manuscript. Clearly, he had seen something in these ordinary buildings, which could in my untutored estimation have belonged to almost any church in Suffolk, which had struck a spark in that queer, obsessive part of his mind. And he, the most civilized, cultivated man I ever met with, those who called me refined in particular never knew him, was also one of the most absent-minded when he was occupied upon an intellectual quest, to the frequent despair of his friends. I gazed at the image until my eyes began to swim. Was this then the riddle which had snatched or enticed my friend from his sleepy station in Weniston? Had he tried to trace this church, wherever it was? Had he even attempted to visit it, researching the Doom's possible birthplace? Was this, perhaps, why, even where, he had vanished? I leapt up and paced before the wooden panels, invigorated by the possibility. Of course Chester had not run away, nor met with any accident, no. He was most likely up to his eyes in dusty parish records, trying to pull off a coup of ecclesiastical history to match the sensational discovery he had already made. If he'd thought he might identify the nameless master who had created this marvellous painting, it would be just like Whittingstall to drop everything and gallop off in pursuit. It all came back to me now. How, when in the grip of one of his enthusiasms, he was also invariably distracted in the extreme, forgetting to eat, dress, or even sleep. It explained everything. The abrupt absence, the lack of any note, the enormous breakfast as he took on board fuel for his journey. But to where, curse it? Where indeed? That was the question. I returned my gaze to the leftmost panel and realised that I had dismissed the building's style as commonplace too easily. Now that I examined it more carefully, there were certain aspects of that heavenly church which seemed distantly familiar. The eccentric windows in their three different styles especially. My eyes ached as I peered at the detail, cudgelling my unwilling brain to give up its forgotten secret. There was the buttress wall to the left, the two arch windows at the top, one squat, one slender, then the arches slits in the middle of the towers, and finally the curious aperture at bottom right, in the form almost of a Maltese cross. Surely, even if the shape and style of the building itself was not unique, there could be only one set of windows so queerly mismatched. For I had seen this place too, I was persuaded, and not so very long ago. Oh, yet the name of it would not come. Though, as I ransacked my memory, a vague vision of a stocky, flint-dappled church with a square tower set in a verdant green hovered in my mind. So striking was the illusion, I felt almost that if I turned around, I might see it clear. But still, it remained nameless, and thus useless to me. Frustrated, I renounced this will-o'-the-wisp, and addressed my attention to the image before me, sharpening my pencil, which my artistic efforts of yesterday had blunted nearly flat, and tracing the first outlines of the church with painstaking precision. The next moment, or so it seemed, the door behind me moaned open, and I heard Oxborough's heavy, shambling tread upon the flagstones. It had been an hour already. My watch confirmed it. And yet once more I had not marked the passage of time, nor been conscious of drawing throughout. But looking down, I saw that I had indeed made a sketch, and a fair rendition of the Doom's heavenly quarter, traced in my usual polite, workmanlike style, lay in my lap. "Back so soon?" I said, grinning a little dazedly over at the verger. I had never known mere copying to enervate me so. He nodded, unsmiling. "Don't want to miss another train, do you, sir?" "No," I said. "No, indeed." I rose in haste and wiped the pencil dust from my fingers, then stuffed Chester's letter in my pocket. I did not think I had left anything else, and if I was entirely honest, could not shake the sensation that I had already outstayed my welcome here, and that both verger and housekeeper would be glad to get shot of me. I packed my valise with unprecedented rapidity, and presented myself at the lich gate of the churchyard within 15 minutes, waiting for Oxborough and his unhurried mare to amble the gig round to meet me. He had assured me he had errands to run in town, something of an aggrandisement, and I did not fancy any sort of walk, however short, with luggage in this heat, so I was grateful for a ride to the station. Once there, I decided, I would speak to the station master and, if possible, the police regarding Whittingstall's disappearance. I could not doubt that they would take the deposition of a Cambridge man more seriously than the vague concerns of an elderly housekeeper in Verger. Besides, Chester had been gone the better part of 4 days now. His was too long an absence to be dismissed lightly. It went hard with me that my attempt to penetrate the mystery of where my friend had vanished to had come to nothing. But at least, I comforted myself, I had made my best effort. The sun had by now seared away any trace of morning coolness, and was beginning to beat in earnest upon my tender, sweating nape. Shifting into the shade of the nearby yew, I paused, and glanced over at the plot from which Oxborough had plucked the grave gifts yester evening. The heaped, wilting flowers seemed undisturbed, and that the dirt beneath them, new-turned though it was, had been dried half to dust by a week of remorseless sun. Whatever I had seen squatting here last night, if, indeed, I had seen anything, it could hardly have left a clear impression in that pale, parched soil. Yet surely, thought I, stepping off the path almost without volition, anything of that size and heft must have left some mark of its passing. A broken stem, a crushed bloom, a flattened nest where it had sat. If only to settle with myself that the whole incident had been the product of a morbid and overstimulated imagination, I crossed rapidly to the grave and examined it with the minutest care. According to the headstone, here lay the earthly remains of one Jane Mary Lambert, died June 20th, 1892, at the venerable age of 64. It was an utterly unremarkable name in history, only notable for the quantity of descendants she had generated in her time on earth. Besides her husband, it seemed she had left 9 living children and 21 grandchildren to mourn her, which doubtless explained the profusion of wild flora and little tributary trinkets which adorned her resting place. The only remainder of the fine pie Oxborough had heaved at the indifferent trees last night, however, was a few crumbs, and several half-dried oily rings where other sweetmeats must have sat. I took a moment to murmur a prayer for the old lady's soul, and turned and looked once more at the church, stones bright in the forenoon glare. I sighed. Alas that I was no detective. I was a scholar merely, and must accept that it was high time I put all this behind me and returned to my waiting books. They, at least, were reliably unexciting, and would not beguile me from my bed at night. My head was still bowed in prayer, else I might never have seen it, and things may yet have been different. I tell myself that now. I do not know if it is true. But this, at least, I will swear to until death stops my mouth. As I stepped back from that grave, a footmark stared up from the loose soil beneath me. And it was not my own. It was as though all the blood in me had been flushed out by ice water. I burned cold and shuddered, blinking to clear my vision as if I had just been immersed.
"Sir?"
came a languid call from behind. "Oxborough, now! Why not 2 minutes ago and save me the agony? Devil take the fellow's timing!"
"One moment!"
I cried, trying to crush the panic from my voice. It was more of a shallow dent, too, in fact, for the heel and ball of the foot, than a sharp impression. And the outline of the print, I suspected, would crumble away at the slightest disturbance. But a print it was, and by its size and contour could be nothing but human. And it was clear, too, that the foot had been naked. What did this mean? My poor sunstruck head swam. That it was true, that Something had been here last night, and that I had seen it. That what I had disavowed and tried to forget, dismissing as a waking dream, had physical substance. Had hands and feet like mine, yet not like mine.
"She's getting restive, sir,"
complained Oxborough, reining in his fidgeting horse. Oh, I could have choked the fellow. But instead, I dropped to my knees in the dirt, unlaced my Oxfords with febrile fingers, and, trembling, tugged off my right shoe and sock. I laid my foot alongside the two depressions that showed where the creature's own had been. They were, near enough, a match. Then, instinctively, impelled by the same urge that leads us to touch our hands against palm prints 1,000 years old, to understand something of he who made them, I gingerly placed my naked foot into the creature's blurred print. It fitted exactly. "I must be off, sir," insisted Oxborough, with real impatience now. Hurriedly, I scrambled on my footwear and hobbled through the gate to meet him in a whirl of flustered apology. I did not speak at all on the drive. Indeed, I could barely think for 2 minutes together. All about me, the sun-dappled hedgerows that jogged alongside our trap seemed foreign and menacing. The cheerful woods through which we drove, studded with hostile eyes. I could not shake off the illusion that we were not alone on our journey. As, perhaps, Chester had not been the last time he left Weniston. I tried to explain it away to myself. I tried to reconcile what I knew of the rational world with what I had seen and suspected here at the church. And I could not. There was too much here for my aching brain to comprehend, too much I could not possibly fathom without a clear, calm head, and ideally a good tot of whiskey to steady me. To tell truth, I was afraid to consider this new and horrid discovery too closely for fear of what it might portend for my friend's safety. Such a beast, so nearby the house of God, so bold to enter the churchyard. And so awfully like the thing in the painting. I did not know what it meant, and in my craven heart, I confess, I did not want to.